Streaming on www.wbai.org. Freedom of Speech Radio.
That's right. That's where your dial is set. 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, streaming at WBAI.org. And coming up right now, a special news feature with Rebecca Miles.
And hello, dear listeners. It's Rebecca Miles joining you today. You may remember me from... sorry, I'm just trying to minimize a lot of things here. It's quite hard sometimes. How do I close that chat? Goodness me. Just my screen is quite small. Here we go. A little mistake there, technically. So, hello, dear listeners. It's Rebecca Miles. You may remember me for a little bit from when I worked alongside those in WBAI's news department, Jose Santiago, Andrea Sears, Ginger Otis, Linda Perry, Desi K. Robinson, Dennis Cabato, and of course, Eric Williams, who passed away untimely 6 years ago this month. In a special show for the next half hour or 25 minutes, I've been granted liberty to share with you some of the highlights from a week of addresses given by world leaders at the United Nations and summarize some of the trends of topics and discussions. The question often asked of the place is, what purpose does it serve and what role does it have in the 21st century? Should it adapt and what form should that take? And I think like many institutions, it's not being tested enough. The people ought to and can demand more, that's you and I, and they can get more involved. And I think it's rare that in this day and age that coming together to meet and trade ideas and hopes and goals for world peace does have a future. But of course, it's up to us. This past week, world leaders from some 160 countries were in New York attending the 77th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Most of you experienced this as gridlock, trying to get up and down New York with streets closed. Bicycling is an absolute nightmare. You couldn't get from 40th Street to 50th unless you went right through the tunnel under the UN. The week is noted for public addresses that grab news headlines, certainly when Trump used to do it, and bilateral meetings where the business of government gets decided, trading deals, treaties, etc. It's one of the few ways in which world leaders can all meet, and its purpose is through diplomacy to maintain international peace and security. It was established after World War II with the aim of preventing future wars, and we've seen how that has gone. Its chief administrative officer is the Secretary General, currently occupied that role is currently occupied by Portuguese politician and diplomat Antonio Guterres, who on Tuesday in his opening address gave a sharp rebuke, warning world leaders in his address, "We can't go on like this," commentating on the state of global conflict. Guterres warned that Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the climate crisis, global food struggles, a threatening world peace, warning of a winter of global discontent on the horizon, and a cost of living crisis is raging. And we all feel it when we go to the supermarket and prices have gone up like 20 cents, 50 cents from last week. So here is just one of the first clips I'll be playing through this special. with Guterres talking to the General Assembly.
There is another battle we must end. Our There is another battle we must end, our suicidal war against nature. The climate crisis is the defining issue of our time, and it must be the first priority of every government and multilateral organization. And yet, climate action is being put on the back burner, despite overwhelming public support around the world. Global greenhouse gas emissions need to be slashed by 45% by 2030 to have any hope of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. And yet, emissions are going up at record levels, on course to a 14% increase this decade. We have a rendezvous with climate disaster. I recently saw it with my own eyes in Pakistan, where one third of the country is submerged by a monsoon on steroids. We see it everywhere. Planet Earth is a victim of scorched earth policies. The past year has brought us Europe's worst heat wave since the Middle Ages. Mega drought in China, the United States and beyond. Famine stalking the Horn of Africa. 1 million species at risk of extinction. No region is untouched. And we ain't seen nothing yet. The hottest summers of today may be the coolest summers of tomorrow. Once in a lifetime, climate shocks may soon become once a year events. And with every climate disaster, we know that women and girls are the most affected. The climate crisis is a case study in moral and economic injustice. The G20 emits 80% of all greenhouse gas emissions, but the poorest and most vulnerable, those who contributed least to this crisis, are bearing its most brutal impacts. Meanwhile, the fossil fuel industry is feasting on hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies and windfall profits while households' budgets shrink and our planet burns. Excellencies, let's tell it like it is. Our world is addicted to fossil fuels, and it's time for an intervention. We need to hold fossil fuel companies and their enablers to account. And that includes the banks, private equity, asset managers, and other financial institutions that continue to invest and underwrite carbon pollution. It includes the massive public relations machine raking in billions to shield the fossil fuel industry from scrutiny, just as they did for the tobacco industry decades before. Lobbyists and spin doctors have spewed harmful misinformation. Fossil fuel interests need to spend less time averting a PR disaster and more time averting a planetary one. Of course, fossil fuels cannot be shut down overnight. A just transition means leaving no person or country behind. But it's high time to put fossil fuel producers, investors and enablers on notice. Polluters must pay. And today I'm calling on all developed economies to tax the windfall profits of fossil fuel companies. Those funds should be redirected in two ways: to countries suffering loss and damage caused by the climate crisis, and to people struggling with rising food and energy prices. As you heard to the COP27 UN climate conference in Egypt, I appeal to all leaders to realize the goals of the Paris Agreement. Lift your climate ambition. Listen to your people's calls for change. Invest in solutions that lead to sustainable economic growth. And let me point to three.
That was Guterres, who headlined a list of many of the most powerful leaders of the world, nearly 160 heads of state and government, addressing the annual meeting earlier this week. He was followed by Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, who spoke next. This coming week, Brazil is having its presidential election. Watchers anticipate Bolsonaro will lose. If he loses, though, they suspect he will call the results invalid. His speech at the UN at times felt like a campaign speech, claiming he'd modernized the Brazilian economy, turned the country into the largest exporter of food, and claimed that 80% of Brazil's Amazon remains untouched. Turning to Ukraine, as so many other world leaders did this week, he was one of the few who called for immediate ceasefire.
The conflict in itself, Brazil has been guided by the principles of international law and the UN Charter, principles that are also enshrined in our national constitution. We advocate an immediate ceasefire, the protection of civilians and non-combatants, the preservation of critical infrastructure to assist the population, and the maintenance of all channels of dialogue between the parties at conflict. These are the first steps towards achieving a solution that will be long-lasting and sustainable. And we have been working in that direction. At the United Nations and also elsewhere, we have tried to avoid hampering the channels of dialogue as a result of polarization around the conflict. Accordingly, we are against diplomatic and economic isolation. The effects of the conflict can already be felt in the world prices of foodstuffs, fuel, and other raw materials. All of this impact drives us all away from the sustainable development goals. Countries that once presented themselves as leaders of the low-carbon economy have now turned to dirty sources of energy. This is a serious setback for the environment. We support all efforts to reduce the economic impacts of this crisis, but we do not believe that the best way is to adopt one-sided or unilateral and selective sanctions that are inconsistent with international law. These measures have harmed economic recovery and have threatened the human rights of vulnerable populations, including in European countries. The solution to the conflict in Ukraine will only be achieved through negotiation and dialogue. I make an appeal to the parties as well as to the entire international community. Let us not miss any opportunity to end the conflict and ensure peace. The stability, security, and prosperity of humankind are at serious risk if the conflict continues.
That, of course, was a translator for Jair Bolsonaro. This year's assembly was different in that it was held in person at the United Nations building after a three-year hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The majority of world leaders and their staff were maskless as they came and went to the United Nations, but staff in the building and the security guards were all masked. The General Assembly, of course, is taking place during a major conflict, Russia's war in Ukraine, which is not only polarizing countries, but being blamed for escalating prices of food and energy. And in speech after speech, world leaders dwelled on the war. Over the 7 months of the war, there have been pointed observations from some quarters about how quickly and extensively wealthy and powerful nations have mobilized money, military aid, and General Assembly votes to support Ukraine and offer refuge to its residents, compared to the global response to other conflicts. Part of Bolivian's President Luis Ecuri's speech compared the untold billions of dollars spent on fighting in Ukraine in a matter of months to the $11 billion committed to UN-sponsored Green Climate Fund over more than a decade. UN humanitarian official figures show that the government and private organizations have put up about $3.7 billion to aid Ukraine and Ukrainian refugees this year. About $2 billion has been raised for a war-torn Yemen, where the UN says over 17 million people are struggling with acute hunger. During US President Joe Biden's address, he said the war was about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state.
Speak plainly. A permanent member of the United Nations Security Council invaded its neighbor, attempted to erase the sovereign state from the map. Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter. No more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force. Again, just today, President Putin has made overt nuclear threats against Europe and a reckless disregard for the responsibilities of the non-proliferation regime. Now, Russia's calling up more soldiers to join the fight, and the Kremlin is organizing a sham referendum to try to annex parts of Ukraine, an extremely significant violation of the UN Charter. This world should see these outrageous acts for what they are. Putin claims he had to act because Russia was threatened. But no one threatened Russia. And no one other than Russia sought conflict. In fact, we warned it was coming. And with many of you, we worked to try to avert it. Putin's own words make his true purpose unmistakable. Just before he invaded, Putin asserted, and I quote, Ukraine was created by Russia and never had, quote, real statehood. And now we see attacks on schools, railway stations, hospitals, one on centers of Ukrainian history and culture. In the past, even more horrifying evidence of Russia's atrocity and war crimes. Mass graves uncovered in Izium. Bodies, according to those who excavated those bodies, showing signs of torture. This war is about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state, plain and simple, and Ukraine's right to exist as a people. Whoever you are, wherever you live, whatever you believe, that should make your blood run cold.
And that was U.S. President Joe Biden this week at the United Nations General Assembly. The General Assembly is where world leaders are supposed to be reporting on their efforts to meet 17 global goals of the sustainable development. These include poverty reduction, quality education, and are supposed to be achieved by 2030. According to UN metrics, the world is falling short on these lofty goals, and in fact, for a second year, no longer made progress. As an example, the number one goal of no poverty in the US, the National Census Bureau data shows that poverty rose for the first time in 2020 to 11.4% after 5 years of consecutive decline. And if you look at number six, clean water and sanitation, a number of US cities have made international headlines for unclean water. If you look towards Flint, Michigan, and now, of course, in Jackson, Mississippi. And closer to home, questionable water for the tenants of NYCHA housing on the Lower East Side. There were, though, addresses that covered other matters. For instance, David Punwella, president of the Federated State of Micronesia, and he might wonder where that is. He represents 600 islands in the Pacific Ocean and said his foreign policy is to be a friend to all and an enemy to none. He talked about some of his Federated States' particular concerns.
Micronesia announced that we were joining the alliance of countries for the deep seabed mining moratorium alongside a number of fellow Pacific SIDs. It is the view of Micronesia that deep seabed mining in the international seabed area should not occur until the precautionary principle, ecosystem approach, and the polluter-based principle have been implemented. In the international seabed area, no such implementation can take place in the absence of the finalization of a robust, responsible, and comprehensive set of exploitation regulations by the International Seabed Authority. To do so otherwise will be a dereliction of our duty to protect and preserve the marine environment and respect the common heritage of mankind. Turning to marine areas within our national jurisdiction, the vast expanse of Micronesian maritime zones represents both an opportunity and, at the same time, enormous challenge. We have some of the largest fishing grounds in the Pacific, covering an area of 1.1 million square miles, and one of the most productive tuna fisheries in the Western and Central Pacific. Our maritime zones are exposed to threats of transnational crimes, illegal activities, and high UU fishing. We need our partners to support us in capacity building efforts towards law enforcement in the areas of maritime surveillance, money laundering, and terrorist financing, drug trafficking, and other transnational crimes. We are thankful to Australia for donating two Guardian-class patrol boats, and also grateful to Japan for complementing these assets with four smaller patrol boats for nearby coastal waters. We recognize the U.S. Coast Guard as an enduring partner in protecting our expansive ocean territory. But given our vast exclusive economic zone and extended continental shelves reaching beyond 200 nautical miles, we invite additional countries to assist us in acquiring more assets with much more advanced maritime surveillance capabilities, such as drones and submersibles. Our law enforcement, border management, and maritime surveillance teams would benefit from more partnership in capacity building and support to continually enhance their law enforcement skills. Mr. President, speaking further about the common heritage of mankind, today, Micronesia wishes to express our gravest concern about Japan's decision to discharge, starting next year, nuclear contaminated water, otherwise known as Advanced Liquid Processing System, or ALPS, water into the Pacific Ocean. We cannot close our eyes to the unimaginable threats of nuclear contamination, marine pollution, and eventual destruction of the blue Pacific continent. The impacts of this decision are both transboundary and intergenerational in nature. As Micronesia's head of state, I cannot allow for the destruction of our ocean resources that support the livelihood of our people.
And that was David Punwela, president of the Federated State of Micronesia, which represents 600 islands in the Pacific Ocean. The deep sea mining Punwela is referring to is a scandal that blew up earlier this month when the New York Times revealed a Canadian mining company called The Mining Company had lobbied secretly a UN agency to gain drilling rights to dredge an area in the Pacific Ocean bed for nodules, which contain essential metals like copper, nickel, lithium, and cobalt to be used in some of the renewable ideas like car batteries. Environmentalists and many civic agencies weren't consulted in discussions and are livid over the threat to the rich biodiversity in the oceans. On Saturday, China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Wang Yi, told the assembly to ensure human prosperity and advancement in the world, and that it must remain open and oppose exclusion, stating that protectionism can only boomerang with decoupling and supply chain disruptions that hurt everybody, and that democracy and human rights should not be used as tools or weapons to achieve political ends. And I think we know what they were getting at there. He ended his speech by saying that Taiwan has been inseparable from China territory since ancient times. And As we end this program, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, spoke at the UN on Saturday and said that years of NATO encroachment on Russia and the West's refusal to negotiate over Ukraine left Russia with no choice but to launch its special military operation. He told the assembly the future of the world order is being decided with the US-led unipolar model receding into the past. After his speech, he took questions from reporters in a press briefing. We'll include as much as we can in the little time that we have left. And just so you know, there is a translator for Lavrov speaking to reporters. And we'll end with that clip. I'm your host, Rebecca Miles, on WBAI Pacifica Radio 99.5 FM. And you can follow me on Twitter at @RebMiles. We'll end now with the piece from Lavrov.
Double standards, as you said. You remember how the West established an exception from international rules for Kosovo, but then the International Court of Justice said that there was no such exception at all. And then, in principle, after Kosovo, it was declared that any part of the territory of any country has the right to determine their own future without the consent of the central authorities. It's double standards. Where they're advantageous, they'll do what they want, and when they're not, they won't.
This is the issue with China Central here. This is the issue with China Central Television. You just mentioned the participation of the Western countries in this conflict. We know that the biggest dealer here is actually the United States, who passed several packages to send weapons to Ukraine. Even the foreign policy of the U.S. said that U.S. politicians now they're trying to play the long game. What do you think is the intention of the United States, and is Russia ready for a long game with the United States in Ukraine?
Well, the Ukrainian game has been ongoing for quite some time now. I would recall that back in 2003, when the latest elections were held in Ukraine, the preparations were underway at the time. Western politicians, officials, minister for foreign ministers, including the Belgian foreign minister, I remember this perfectly well. He explicitly proclaimed that Ukrainians during those elections need to determine who they were with Russia, with Europe. And this kind of a mindset, this philosophy, either them or us, hasn't disappeared. And the way that today we see the Russophobic trends, which are raging rampant throughout Europe, and the Europeans and Americans are trying to bring the whole world into this disgraceful policy, the actions of the West at the moment, when immediately Russian Russophobia, regular Russophobia was encouraged and the Russian language prohibited, this is racism, which apparently didn't disappear. It's no longer latent, it is now obvious, and this is being spread and proliferating. The same with those slogans, Ukrainians, choose who you're with, and a few years later there were other elections, the candidate that was not embraced by the West didn't win, and the West did everything possible to raise a wave in Ukraine and to compel its subordinate Ukrainian officials to hand over the issue to the Constitutional Court. And the Constitutional Court, which is supposed to protect the Constitution, set out a third round of elections, which is not enshrined in the Constitution, and the necessary candidate for the United States was then selected. So, you know, in December of 2013, there was a publication of what leaked the recording the television discussion between Victoria Nuland and the American ambassador in Kiev. The American ambassador in Kiev was being reported to, this was back in December, about which politician was reporting which politicians need to be prepared for the new government, even though there was more than a year before the elections. So a certain likelihood of an abnormal transfer of power was possible, and Nuland named a few names which he thought had to be included in the leadership of Ukraine. And to this, the U.S. ambassador in Kiev said, well, you know, this specific individual, he is not supported by the European Union. Do you remember what she answered? the EU. So this is the relationship. This is the truth. And